Why character remains important. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, my vice chairman, good friend, fellow analyst, and man who tries to follow after God's will, Chuck Mikus.
And I appreciate that description. Thank you very much. And I'm also the technical director here, so if you hear any quality problems, it's just because it's a really nasty day outside, and we're having a little trouble maintaining our Skype connection.
Yeah, well, thank the Lord for Skype. But you know what?
That's right.
When we're doing these, this isn't the only time that Chuck and I sit and chat and talk about the issues of the day and principles and policies. Sometimes we'll call each other up on the phone and say, hey, did you see this particular article by this person? And, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's what's generated today's program. You see, because Chuck was reading an article in townhall.com by columnist Dennis Prager, who's a nationally syndicated columnist, in relation to a lot of the events that have been going on around specifically the Republican presidential primaries. His article is entitled, it was first article, we're going to be talking about his second article tomorrow. This first article there was entitled, What Does Adultery Tell Us About Character? And Chuck and I thought, well, you know, we've done a program on why character is important. We ought to see what this national syndicated columnist, who's a conservative and religious, I believe he's Jewish, says about character. Well, Chuck, I'm going to let you just tell the folks what your initial reaction to this was, because I know what my reaction to his article was.
Well, I can tell you that the first thing I saw, I did not see the first article first. I saw the second article first. And it became clear to me that something bad happened in the first article, because the second article was really an attempt to vigorously defend what he had said in the first article. And I said, okay, it must be really, really bad, because the statements that he makes in his defense are themselves really, really, really bad. So the bottom line is that, and indeed we were correct, everything that's been said in these articles is really, really, really bad.
Well, that was kind of my take on it as well. I mean, here I thought, okay, yeah, here's someone who has a deep understanding of his own faith, of his Jewish faith, who has been what we consider a conservative columnist through all these years, and he's writing on the issue of character. And I thought, wow, okay, finally we're going to get down to it. And what did I find? Basically, it was his first article that we're reading here was basically an apologetic as to why the commission of adultery by a candidate, it isn't really all that big of a deal, and that maybe we're all being hypocritical by making too much out of it. Now, you know, Chuck, you and I have heard those things before from others that, well, you know, going all the way back, you know, to the Clinton White House and things, and somebody's personal life shouldn't matter, and it's the job they do in the White House. In other words, it's a works mentality. It doesn't matter where their heart lies as long as what they're doing outside seems to be okay. And honestly, I expected more from Dennis Prager. I expected more from someone who states in the article, I am a religious conservative.
Yeah.
And basically, what he's trying to do is he's trying to basically undermine the idea of the view, if a man can't keep his vows to his wife, how can we trust him to keep his vows to his country? And he basically says this statement has no basis in fact. It's a non sequitur. We have no reason to believe that men who've committed adultery are less likely to be great leaders, or that men who have always been faithful are more likely to be great leaders. And then he tries to use King David as an example.
Yes.
You know, King David and his adultery with Bathsheba. And yes, we know, but we also understand that David was brought to an account through God by Nathan, who basically exposed his adultery, and that David suffered serious consequences, and so did his children, and so did the nation for his sin.
Yeah, and what eventually happened was, if you follow it along, it didn't happen during David's generation, but the nation split.
The nation split. Over, you had the northern and the southern kingdoms.
Over basically some of the things that were done during David's reign, and including this, the killing of Uriah, I'm sorry, and the stealing of his wife, Bathsheba. And eventually that sort of led to a split in the kingdom because Bathsheba's son, who became Solomon, created jealousy among the actual firstborn. You know, Israel didn't have what we know as primogeniture. That is, the first son is the automatic heir to the throne. And therefore, what that did was created a split. And so Absalom ran his own little revolution. The split was already there because of Saul and David and the things that happened there.
Mm-hmm.
What this did was Absalom's revolt basically widened the split so that when Solomon came in, things were okay, but the feelings were underneath. And when Solomon died, the son, whose name escapes me at the moment, Solomon had run taxes up and basically run a forced labor program to build his capital. Voila, you've got an instant split. Were there long-term consequences to David's inability to control himself? The answer is absolutely there were. And looking at it in the short term is a really bad way to look at these things.
Mm-hmm. You're right. And well, Prager keeps going on with this, Jack. I mean, it's amazing, ladies and gentlemen. You know, he keeps going with all of these, what I consider to be red herring arguments, trying to set up this argument why we shouldn't worry about a man who's committed adultery. And he said, and I'll quote from his article, he says, "While on the subject of leadership," you know, that was the King David issue, "another question for religious and or conservative readers who believe that a man who sexually betrays his wife will likely betray his country, who would you prefer for president? A pro-life conservative who had had an affair, or a pro-choice man to the left who had always been faithful to his wife?" Now, automatically, Charles, we understand that probably most of the conservatives and religious conservatives, it's a knee-jerk to say, oh, well, somebody who's pro-life, because, you know, where you stand on life depends on where you stand on everything else. Not quite so fast, because we have to look at this not from the perspective of politics or of the here and now. We have to look at the perspective of an eternal perspective. We have to look at God's perspective on this whole issue. And I know I'm going to be stepping on a number of toes out there, and so I apologize if it hurts, but I'm not the one doing the stepping. It's God. God clearly has spelled out in his word that a man who commits adultery gets a stain that never comes away, a spot that will never be taken away. That, honestly, if you look at the commandments, adultery is one of the 10. It made the top 10 of things that you shouldn't do. I know thou shalt not kill, and dealing with the abortion issue also makes the top 10. But Scripture is very clear that if you have violated in any one of these commandments, you've violated them all. And the point is that when you commit adultery, not only are you just violating the commandment on adultery, you're violating the commandment on coveting. You're coveting that which you do not have, and by virtue of your marriage vows, is unavailable to you. And that is having a sexual relationship with someone who's not your wife. Okay, so what it really gets down to is when you're violating the commandment on adultery, you're also violating commandment against coveting. You're also harboring in your heart a desire for something that's not godly. Therefore, by implication, you're violating the top commandments against having something else as your God and having an idol. And I know somebody can say, well, that's tenuous, but no, honestly, if you really think about it and follow the logic, for a man to want to violate the covenantal vows that he's made with the woman who becomes one flesh with him and wants to throw those off to commit adultery, that means that no rule or covenant or law or regulation is sacrosanct to him. He will, when the mood suits him, throw off even those other issues like pro-life. Now, Chuck, I know that question is, you know, that's a false dichotomy. It's a false either or.
Right. But
really what it gets down to is, okay, I'll play the game with Dennis. Who would I rather have? I'd rather have the pro-choice man on the left who's been faithful, because if he's been faithful to his wife, that means he understands that there's something higher than himself. And if that's the case, then I can work an apologetic with that man to bring him around to understanding that if you believe that you shouldn't commit adultery, you should also believe that you shouldn't take an innocent life.
Well, what's interesting here is this is a worldview issue. This is not something, you know, both positions would be flawed. Now,
yes, absolutely.
Both positions are deeply flawed. Now, you're right. The pro-choicer has this idea that his vows mean something. And the pro-lifer who cheats on his wife, well, what makes anybody think that the vow to his wife is any different than his vow to protect life? The answer is there's no reason to believe that his vow to protect life is any better than his vow to his wife. He follows it as long as it meets his needs at the moment. And that's the reason that you would cheat on your wife, is the fact that you see something that comes along that looks pleasing to the eye and you want it. And what if that girlfriend, that mistress, got pregnant and you wanted to so badly to protect your reputation that you decided that maybe abortion wasn't such a bad thing? That's where that road leads. Now you've got it. Now you've got a false dichotomy here too, in that let's look at this statement that he makes. Would John F. Kennedy, a serial adulterer while in the White House, have been any different a president were he faithful? And I think the answer to that is yes, he would have, because I think that would have spoken volumes about what his actual worldview was. And the answer is, first of all, that's a theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can never know for sure. But the fact is that, yes, he was a serial adulterer. And no, he didn't have any trouble violating his oath of office. John Kennedy was no great president, and he was nothing great about maintaining his constitutional, you know, his presidency within its constitutional bounds. He abused it like everybody else has since about 1865. So the idea, you know, the question is, A, it's moot because John Kennedy was a serial adulterer while in the White House, and B, because it sets up a completely false dichotomy.
Well, and here's another false dichotomy that's set up in this article. And I know you folks, if you want to comment on this or you think we're way off base on this, that's fine. Drop us an email at our website at principlepolicy.com. Or chat on the, when we post this up online, on our, iTunes feed, then you can respond back to us and let us know that we're off base. But the point is, I don't think we are off base, because here again, this is Prager. He says, as a married person, I know how much it would hurt my wife and how much it would hurt me if the other had an affair. Okay. I think we can all agree with that. Then he goes into this, and here's where I really part company with Dennis Prager. He says, but marriage is too complex an arena to draw any immediate conclusions about a person. Are we to label a man who takes loving care of his chronically ill wife and who has a discreet affair no more than an adulterer who merits disdain and mistrust? Is a woman who stays in an emotionally abusive marriage for the sake of her children someone with little integrity because she sought to be held in another man's loving arms? The questions and nuances are innumerable. Well, I'll agree with that last statement he said. They are innumerable when you start wanting to nuance sin, when you start wanting to nuance something that God clearly states is a violation of his law. When you want to nuance something that God says adultery is a stain that will leave a blot that will not be clean. That when adultery is a sin that Christ, who said, if you've looked after a woman to lust after her, you've committed adultery already in your heart.
Exactly. And look at, now we're basically out of time. So, I'm going to say this real quick and then we're going to sign off. And Dennis Prager asked this question, What is adultery? Women have called my show to tell me that a man who gets a lap dance has committed adultery. Others go further, merely attending a strip show or looking at a Playboy. is adultery. To my mind, this is emotion, not reason, morality, or religion talking. Well, folks, that's not a Christian view of sin. And
no,
unfortunately, we are completely out of time. So we're going to continue this tomorrow. Join us tomorrow at 5:30 for more principles and policies.